y'all. It's Dusty and Mike with exciting news.
That's right. It's our episode finder. It's all about making finding our episodes even easier.
Want to find more episodes about hikes in Shenandoah? With over 10 episodes across two separate seasons, it would have involved a lot of scrolling and searching.
Now, with our episode finder, you can find all those episodes with a few easy clicks. That way, finding an episode on Yosemite from season one is just as easy as finding an episode on Zion, Yellowstone, and Haleakala, all in separate seasons.
With over 275 episodes in 35 different national parks, our episode finder will add ease when finding out more about hikes in these spaces.
But it's not just about hikes by national park. We've categorized our entire library so you can find hikes by state, hikes by terrain, and hikes by difficulty.
And all of our Trail Mix episodes are there too, so you can easily find our science-based episodes, interviews, and more.
Planning a trip to Colorado and want to hear more about our adventures there? Want to grunt it out on some really tricky trails or learn more about glaciers, grasslands, and mountains?
Just click the link in our show notes or on our Instagram bio, and it pops right up. You can also head directly to our website and look for the episode finder at the top of the navigation bar.
Conquer one hike in one national park, one park at a time, with just a few clicks with our episode finder. Happy trails! The long, lazy days of summer have arrived, and with them, the opportunity to travel and see new places.
Maybe you're headed abroad to Paris, the City of Lights, and home of the 2024 Olympics. Or perhaps your journeys are taking you south of the equator to Peru for an epic hike to Machu Picchu, or to Bolivia to see the salt flats of Uyuni.
Or maybe like us, you're finding your travels are closer to home on the trails of a national park, like Mount Rainier, Shenandoah, or Yosemite.
From hikes to hotels to the best spots to eat, Moon Travel has you covered.
From excellent first-hand experience from authors who are local to the areas they are writing about, to wonderful maps and great recommendations, Moon Travel Guides give the reader so much more than other travel guides on the market.
That's right, and we are so excited that this year we are again partnering with Moon Travel.
Through this partnership, through the end of 2024, our listeners can get 20% off any Moon Travel Guide when they use the code GAZE24 at checkout.
That's code GAZE24, GAZE24, for 20% off any Moon Travel Guide in Moon's entire library, and you actually will not find this deal anywhere else, everybody. Head to our show notes to check it out and see Moon's entire collection of guidebooks.
So ready to cross something off your travel bucket list in 2024?
Have a lot of great ideas for trips, but don't know how to get started or keep your itinerary organized?
Wherever your wanderings may take you or inspire you to go, Moon Travel Guides have you covered.
Head to moon.com and use code GAZE24 at checkout to open up the world of possibilities for your next trip.
Moon Travel. Let your heart be your compass. Let Moon be your guide.
Hello and welcome to Gaze at the National Parks, the podcast. I'm Dusty.
And I'm Mike, and welcome to our Season 6 Summit.
If you are new to the podcast, our Summit episodes are how we wrap up each season of Gaze at the National Parks, the podcast. It's our way of looking at each of the parks from this season through four different lenses.
While in each of our main stage episodes, we get a chance to talk about hikes in a national park, we don't often get to encompass a larger view of the park space itself. Our Summit episodes allow us to look at the parks from the season by examining the visitor experience, the history, the environment and wildlife, and on a much grander scale, the hiking and experiences within the parks.
In this Summit episode, we will be discussing history, a subject the both of us thrived in and loved and continue to love to this day. It's true. While I may have a blind spot for presidential history and Mike's world history might be a little rusty, it's something that continues to intrigue us both and drives our curiosity to know more. Trying to talk about the history of one place is a really big job. So for our Summit on Histories, we have sorted through and pulled at the pieces that seem most appropriate to this episode. If we started pulling at all of the pieces, we might be buried below a Jenga brick pile of information.
There is a ton of information to always discuss, especially about the parks. It comes in all different sorts of formats. It also comes in all different sorts of histories, from the indigenous people in the parks to settlers that may have come into the space to sometimes mining operations to the way that the park space is operated
to climate change to a whole host of other things.
And so one can very quickly feel, oh, I pulled too many bricks out and now they have come crashing down upon me.
Yeah. Another way I like to think about it when it comes to like a Jenga tower, it's all of that history is living together and all of it is being, you know, built together to create what it is.
Yes.
And if you were to try to remove one thing, you can't.
Yeah.
Because it you is
gotta,
connected to everything.
Exactly. You got
to
kind of talk about everything in some way, shape, or form.
Let's talk about parks in order this time, examining a little bit of our history from each of these parks. Now, as we've stated before, this is by no means the entire history of any one of these park spaces, as we would be here for a multitude of episodes on each park if that were the case. But rather, this is a broader overview to provide some context.
Our first park from the season was Mammoth Cave. We would like to acknowledge that while hiking and visiting the land, also known as Mammoth Cave National Park, that we were on the traditional and stolen lands of the Cherokee, Shawnee, and Yuchi people.
When it comes to the indigenous people that inhabited the land, now also known as Mammoth Cave National Park, we know that the human history of the park started about 12,000 years ago, and that the cave exploration about 4,000 to 5,000 years ago. The people of the area were mostly hunter-gatherers who utilized the cave for its resources, mainly gypsum. It is uncertain what the gypsum was used for, as the soft mineral would not do well outside of the environment of the cave. But several theories have emerged, including use in agriculture, ritual, or medicine.
The original people of the area explored about 19 miles of the 426-mile-long cave. Evidence of these early people comes by way of materials left within the cave, as well as petroglyphs carved into the cave walls and pictographs, which were added to the cave walls with charcoal pigment. Eventually, the caves became less and less used by these early people.
While the caves were likely used year-round, preserved waste samples show that the late spring through early fall were likely peak times of use. Along with utilizing Mammoth Cave, several other sites on the Mammoth Cave property were used by these first people, including Salts Cave, Dixon Cave, and Martin Cave.
When it comes to later cave exploration, Mammoth Cave has a deep and storied history, which at some points is a little intense. To hear a little more about caving, specifically in the Mammoth Cave system, and some more of the history of the cave, be sure to check out our Trail Mix episode from this season titled Caving with Bruce Hatcher.
Mammoth Cave's discovery and use by white settlers to the area eventually became several enterprises that erupted into what is known as the Cave Wars. Because capitalism, essentially, a multitude of smaller caves, which were near Mammoth Cave, became a draw for landowners to create adjacent cave experiences for a nominal fee.
Some of these caves would eventually be discovered to be a part of the larger Mammoth Cave system. But at the time, prior to the Civil War, these caves provided a lucrative business opportunity for those individuals who owned the property the cave was on.
Eventually, those with caves, in an effort to create a bigger draw, pushed the boundary of cave exploration at the time in order to find access points to Mammoth Cave within the caves on their properties. Because Mammoth Cave was such a draw, these entrepreneurs knew that they would have an edge on their competition if they could find another way to access Mammoth Cave. Some even blew their way into the cave, like George Morrison, who created a, quote, new entrance into Mammoth Cave, end quote, illegally.
Part of keeping an independent cave alive was having access to it. At the time of the locomotive, if the cave wasn't close enough to the train station that fed Mammoth Cave, it was difficult to lure guests there. As the automobile became popular, advertising by way of what were known as cave cappers, whose booths lined the highways, was key, as well as signage.
Caving in the park would not have been possible without the help of those early cave explorers, such as Stephen Bishop, who was an enslaved African American. He was placed in the cave originally as a guide, but eventually began acting as an explorer in his own right. He not only discovered many portions of the cave and helped to map it, but he was instrumental in expanding the reach of cave exploration through his crossing of the bottomless pit. While he did eventually gain his freedom and began working as a paid guide within the cave in 1856, within a year, he was dead due to unknown causes. Bishop was not only incredibly important in the further discovery of Mammoth Cave, but a well-respected caver and guide by those who came to visit.
Now, let's turn our attention to Big Bend National Park. We'd like to acknowledge that while hiking and visiting the land, also known as Big Bend National Park, that we are on the traditional and stolen land of the Humanos, Cahokatan, Mescalero Apache, and Chizos people.
The early people of the area, now also known as Big Bend National Park, can be seen in several waves up to the introduction of white European settlers to the region in the 1500s. From 10,000 to 6500 BCE, the area of what is now also known as Big Bend National Park was a very different and larger flora and fauna were present. The climate shifted slightly. While still cool and wet, there came a gradual influx of heat. The large game of the time became a primary source of food, clothing, and shelter for the inhabitants of the park. As the climate shifted with the end of the last ice age, which was between 6500 and 1000 BCE, much of the megaflora and fauna either died out, was overhunted, or moved. This caused the indigenous people of the land to hunt smaller game and use more plants for food, clothing, and shelter. Spears were used as a primary weapon when hunting. This was an era where people adapted to the environment and relied more on the resources of the earth to help support a more thriving material culture.
Eventually, more sophisticated weapons were developed, including the bow and arrow, which helped to aid in hunting. The period from 1000 BCE to the arrival of Europeans in the 1500s was marked with advancements in agriculture, crafts, and greater trade. With the arrival of Spanish missionaries in the 1500s, the Chizos people had moved high into the mountain regions of the park. Eventually, the Comanche people were ushered into the land in and around what is now the park and maintained a strong presence in the region for over 100 years. That is, of course, until these native people were eventually forced out due to expansion from the west by frontiersmen.
One bit of fascinating history which is still being uncovered within the park is its rich fossil record. One thing to definitely do while you are in the park is to take time to visit the fossil discovery exhibit. This is right near the Panther Junction Visitor Center, and it is something you can hear more about in episode 109 from this season entitled Small Trails.
The very cool thing about Big Bend National Park, which is different from a park like Badlands from last season, is that there were dinosaurs here within the park. Now, at some point, like much of the Midwest, Big Bend was covered by a shallow sea known as the Western Interior Seaway. We chat all about this in our Trail Mix episode from season 5 titled Fossils of the Badlands. This is the reason why you won't find any dinosaur fossils in Badlands, because it was covered with water. However, you will find fossils of ancient marine life there.
Big Bend, unlike Badlands, eventually dried out. Well, not all the way, at least not right away, but enough so that terrestrial dwelling dinosaurs could wander around. In fact, Big Bend has an incredible fossil record that spans beyond terrestrial dwelling dinosaurs to mammals, plants, and yes, even some of those creatures of the not-so-deep, shallow Western Interior Seaway.
From the Western Interior Seaway to swampland to floodplain to eventual desert, the shifting landscape of the park over millions of years gave a great deal of prehistoric value to the park by way of fossils.
Next, let's turn our attention to Wind Cave National Park. We would like to acknowledge that while hiking and visiting the land also known as Wind Cave National Park, that we were on the traditional and stolen land of the Oglala Lakota, Cheyenne, Osheti Shekoan, Mini-Koju, and many other indigenous people.
It is from the Lakota that the creation story which involves Wind Cave is told. In this story, the first people emerge from Wind Cave to populate the earth, but that is not before the trickery of earthbound spirits forced other humans to the surface, in direct disobeyal of the creator. These disobeyers became the first buffalo, whom the creator told the true first people to follow for food, tools, clothes, and shelter. While the opening of Wind Cave was once much larger, as the true first people entered onto the earth, the creator shrunk the hole down in order to help remind people where they had come from.
This creation story is obviously much more involved than this summary, but it underscores why Wind Cave is so important to the original indigenous people of the plains. As settlers moved into the area, Wind Cave became more of a spectacle and less of a sacred site.
With the discovery of the cave by the Bingham brothers in 1881, the cave went through several waves of interest and popularity. While the cave was first explored by Charlie Crary of Custer, South Dakota, by squeezing his way into the natural entrance and moving along by candlelight, eventually a larger opening was created to allow ease of entrance.
There was eventually speculation in the cave through mining rights from the South Dakota Mining Company, with J.D. McDonald acting as the manager of the claim. With him came his three children, his son Alvin became enamored with the cave itself, so much that Alvin began to document and map the cave through systematic exploration.
Though the mining operation was a bust, the cave garnered interest as a spectacle. Eventually, the McDonald's took on a business partner in John Stabler. As time waxed on and the cave became more popular, so much so that a hotel was built nearby, the South Dakota Mining Company came calling to claim the land back.
Years of lawsuits, which first saw Stabler and McDonald as co-defendants against the mining company, eventually saw Stabler and McDonald vying for the rights to the land and the cave for themselves. In 1900, the cases were ultimately settled, as no party other than the federal government would retain the land, as it would eventually be removed from settlement and shortly thereafter designated a national park.
Moving away from the caves and capitalism, let's turn now to Gateway Arch National Park. We would like to acknowledge that while visiting the land, also known as Gateway Arch National Park, that we are on the traditional and stolen land of the Kickapoo, Kaskaskia, Osage, Miamia, Ogapa, and Ocheti Shikoan.
The history of Gateway Arch National Park is ultimately tied to the Louisiana Purchase and the history of the city of St. Louis. You can hear more about this in our Trail Mix episodes from this season titled The Core of Discovery, as well as episode 113, Gateway Arch National Park, part 1.
Because of St. Louis' strategic point on the Mississippi River, the city acted as a jumping-off point to the west, as well as a center of commerce for the country from north to south. As the boundaries of the country ebbed ever westward, even prior to the Louisiana Purchase, settlers pressed their luck as they moved west.
Eventually, as land opened up legally to white settlers, manifest destiny emboldened them to claim what they believed to be rightfully theirs. This led to conflicts, treaties, and eventual removal of Native peoples from land that was in fact rightfully theirs. Both the reservation system and the programs of conversion of Native people to a more European, American, and Christian way of life became mainstays.
The expansion westward not only removed Native people from their land, but also worked toward erasure of their culture. One such erasure that occurred in the city of St. Louis was that of their mounds. St. Louis was once known as Mound City, yet today no mounds remain within the city. In fact, the closest you'll be able to find mounds of a similar quality is several miles east at Cahokia Mounds State Historic Site.
The mounds that were scattered about the city of St. Louis and can be found at Cahokia show a thriving and complex economic and social structure of these indigenous people prior to the settlement of white Europeans. They also represent some of the most impressive and complex archaeological sites north of Mexico in the Americas.
The mounds that once populated the city of St. Louis, giving it the name Mound City, were removed to make way for the development of the city itself. While some of these mounds acted as burial sites for the Osage Nation, others may have served purposes like those at Cahokia, as public buildings and for astronomical study.
The arch, which was created to commemorate the expansion westward, also commemorates a great deal of pain for indigenous people and national shame for our treatment of these original caretakers. While the arch gives the city a unique skyline, it also acts as a blight and a reminder of wounds that may never be healed. It is no wonder that so many people question the elevation of this monument to national park status. Okay, have you ever been traveling abroad and then received a huge roaming bill for your cell phone afterwards, or lost phone service or connectivity while traveling, or found yourself desperately searching for free Wi-Fi, or have you ever wasted your time at the airport trying to find a SIM vendor? Well, then look no further than Arelo. Arelo is the world's first eSIM store that solves the pain of high roaming bills by giving you access to eSIMs, or digital SIM cards. It's trusted by 10 million travelers worldwide, founded in 2019 with a mission to provide global data connectivity to all travelers, and Arelo is the first and leading eSIM store on the market. And what's great is that there's no waste. It's 100% digital. Forget about physical SIM cards or putting cards in your phone. Arelo is a digital solution, so it eliminates the need for packaging, mailing materials, or physical distribution. It is created to to save you time and money. No more roaming fees, no more lines at the airport to purchase a local SIM card, no more hassle looking for a strong Wi-Fi connection at the airport. Also, using eSIM, you get to keep your home phone number. Connect to local networks wherever you travel because Airalo has you covered in more than 200 countries and regions. Stay connected from the moment you land. Airalo has local, regional, and global eSIMs. And it's super easy to use. There's an app available that you can download and you can easily monitor and track your data usage. I know I'm always worried about roaming charges when I travel abroad, but now I don't have to. And neither do you, because you can install Airalo today and you can use our code GAZE to get $3 off your first eSIM. And that's code GAZE, G-A-Z-E, to get $3 off your first eSIM with Airalo. As someone who is constantly curious about the birds in my neighborhood, from those on the branches to those in the air, I often have trouble identifying what I'm hearing or what I'm seeing because they may be moving too fast for me to get a good view of. FeatherSnap takes the often tricky art of bird identification and makes it so much simpler through its top-of-the-line camera and incredible AI programming. After setting up my FeatherSnap bird feeder in my yard, I couldn't believe the birds I was seeing and capturing in photos and videos. If anything, the excitement of having a bird appear at the feeder and then be captured by the camera only stoked my excitement for what other birds might appear and what birds I should be on the lookout for while I was out and about. If you're looking to up your bird watching game or want to get your friends and family engaged in and excited about the birds in your area, then FeatherSnap is for you. From its solar-powered, top-of-the-line camera, in its unique dual bin feeder, to its incredible mobile app, which collects photos and videos at the feeder, FeatherSnap is a complete game changer. Check them out today at feathersnapcam.com. That's feathersnapcam.com.
As we continue on, we turn our sights south from St. Louis to Hot Springs, Arkansas. We would like to acknowledge that while visiting the land also known as Hot Springs National Park, that we are on the traditional and stolen lands of the Osage, Quapaw, and Caddo people.
Hot Springs National Park's history, when it comes to white settlers, also has its roots in the Louisiana Purchase, as the Dunbar Hunter Expedition passed through the area in 1804, charged by Thomas Jefferson to explore the southern portion of the land deal.
Prior to exploration and settlement by white Europeans and later Americans, it is believed that indigenous people inhabited the land known as Hot Springs for at least 8,000 years, and for 3,000 of those years, they called the land home. The Quapaw were the main tribe attributed to the Hot Springs region, and were said to have used the springs as their water was quite strengthening.
Eventually, as white settlers moved into the area and eventually outnumbered the remaining Quapaw, land became a top priority through two treaties, one signed in 1818 and a later signed in 1824. The Quapaw ceded much of their land to Americans who moved into the area, displacing the Quapaw to Louisiana. Their journey to this new state, like many other indigenous tribes who were displaced, was nothing shy of disastrous.
As white settlers found the land, now known as Hot Springs National Park, they soon recognized that the space could become a health resort. By the 1830s, permanent structures were established. In 1832, the land became federally protected, some of the earliest parkland to be set aside. That being said, no additional legislation was created around the space, so people flocked to the area to set up shop.
Initially, the area of what is now Hot Springs Town was not altogether different from rough frontier towns. When a fire swept through the town in 1878, a renaissance opportunity emerged as new construction and more stringent laws were put into place to ensure better construction. This assured an era of luxury to the town and cemented it further as a center for health and wellness.
While the bathhouses, with all their opulence, flourished through the 1960s, eventually there came a decline, as bathhouse after bathhouse closed. Only the Buckstaff remained open, as it does today, and continues to offer the traditional spa experience.
Let's turn our gaze now upward toward our final park, Shenandoah National Park. We would like to acknowledge that while visiting the land also known as Shenandoah National Park, that we were on the traditional and stolen land of the Monohoic people.
In our Season 2 summit, which also included Shenandoah, we touched on the Monohoic people and their history in the region, as well as the intersection of the national park and the Civil War. As Shenandoah has a deep history, as we come to this portion of the episode, we wanted to focus in on the creation of the park itself through the land grabs and the work of the CCC.
Without the CCC, much of Shenandoah would not have come to be. During the height of the Great Depression, 2 years before the establishment of Shenandoah National Park in earnest, the first two CCC camps located within the national parks were both established in Shenandoah, one at Skyland and the other at Big Meadows. This expanded to 10 camps between 1933 and 1942, either within the park or adjacent to it.
Along with working to create trails, build fire roads and towers, and help with the construction of Skyline Drive, they also worked to landscape the park.
The park itself wrested much of its land from the residents through eminent domain, as the state of Virginia reclaimed the land and passed it on to the federal government for the creation of the national park. This work, which was disguised as virtuous by helping the poor and destitute people of the Blue Ridge Mountains enter the 20th century, was in fact fairly duplicitous.
Well, some of these communities that would eventually be cobbled together to make the park were in fact rather poor, a large majority of the communities were thriving while living a simpler life. While some of the residents of what was to become the park were given life estates, whereby their death the land would be returned to the park, those who were forced off the land or bought out of it needed to relocate.
As for the CCC, a major part of their work post-1935 was to erase the evidence of human occupation from the boundaries of the park unless the homesteads within the park had been designated to be saved. Along with completely deconstructing homes, they removed gardens, uprooted orchards, and returned the land to its natural splendor.
The sources for this summit episode include the NPS Park websites for Mammoth Cave, Big Bend, Wind Cave, Gateway Arch, Hot Springs, and Shenandoah National Parks.
The articles on the Kentucky Cave Wars and Stephen Bishop from Mammoth Cave National Park website.
The articles on human history and fossils from the Big Bend National Park website.
The Cahokia Mound State Historic website and the article St. Louis was once Mound City. Its Native American residents still feel erased from St. Louis Public Radio. By Brittany Cordera.
The article on Wind Cave National Park from npshistory.gov.
The article This is Indian Land, Hot Springs National Park by Jessica Mehta.
And the articles The Displaced and Shenandoah Not Without the CCC from the Shenandoah National Park website.
Now, let's end this summit with a queen and a game. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage.
When do you want it?
God, I love this queen.
Mm-hmm.
Wendy Yawana.
Mm-hmm.
I do feel like she has Melissa Shimenti energy from
Abbott Elementary.
From Abbott Elementary. Mm-hmm. Good Lord, I do love.
Yeah. She's from Philadelphia.
Oh my God, what is her name?
I don't know, but she was Chessie. And
I can only. She's Chessie, right? Oh my God, her name. Lisa Ann Walter. That's her name.
Okay.
And lest we forget.
I guess we will never forget.
No. Mm-hmm. But I do feel like, Wendy Yawanit is like a cousin of...
Celeste we forget.
Mm-hmm. Also a cousin of Melissa Shimenti.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Wendy Yawanit.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like she's owns the salon.
Okay.
You know, people are like, hey, I want to come get a perm. When you want it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like she's got
tomorrow at 10 a.m.
Mom energy is what I'm feeling.
Totally is mom energy.
Like, when do you want it? What do you want? Like, mm-hmm. When do you want me to bring you there?
Yeah.
Yeah. She's rough around the edges.
Mm-hmm.
She's got an accent.
She does.
She's here to tell you how it is. And you better be ready. Because it's coming whether you want it or not.
When you want it?
Yeah.
Whether you like it or not.
So I feel like she's like an insult comic.
Yes.
Yeah. Queen.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. She's telling it like it is.
Oh, yeah.
As they say.
Mm-hmm.
What's the song she lip syncs to?
I'm just imagining her lip syncing to Hung Up by Madonna. Time moves by so slowly.
Uh-huh. And just but like
maybe not
just like hitting her watch acapella over and over again. Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
No, I like that.
Hung Up.
She's
by
got
Madonna.
Judge Judy energy.
She does. Oh, that's exactly who it is.
That's it.
She's
it's
got
Judge Judy energy.
Yeah. I do feel like wristwatches are her swag.
Yeah, and it's, I feel like it's watches. Her face on the watch.
Yeah.
Her face going like, you know?
That was a very Kathy sort of pantomime Kathy, that you gave. Kathy-esque.
Kathy, like the...
comic strip Kathy.
The comic strip.
Mm-hmm.
Chocolate, chocolate, chocolate. Ack.
Exactly. So, Thaddeus and Gentlethems, please welcome to the stage. When do you want it?
And let's end this summit with a round of Jeopardy-style trivia. What have you got prepared for us now, Mike?
Well, speaking of threads, which we started talking about at the beginning, specifically with threads of history, we're going to play a game that ties some loose threads together from history as it relates to the national parks.
Great.
I'm going to offer you three events in history that have a connection thread of a year. And every three events with the common year is also going to share the same year of one of the national parks from the season when it was established.
Oh,
so hold tight. Don't panic yet. I'm going to give you the year and the park, and I'm also going to give you some clues. You're just going to need to answer the clues. So you're going to know basically everything. You just got to give me the answers to the clues. You'll see how it goes as soon as it... Everything is based off of a single year.
Got it. You'll be fine. I understand that. I'm following that.
Okay.
Yeah, great.
The year is 1941, and Mammoth Cave is established as a national park. There's going to be three events I'm going to give you clues to. You're going to need to name all three.
I got it. Okay. Yeah.
This military base is bombed by the Japanese. Edward Hopper finishes this painting, which is one of his best known, and this female superhero with ties to Greek mythology hits the comic book stands for the first time.
Okay, so the superhero is Wonder Woman.
That's correct.
Pearl Harbor.
That's correct.
And then is it Swablur?
No, it's not.
That's the only Hopper I know.
The Edward Hopper painting, you definitely know it. It features three individuals in a diner, and we're looking in at them.
Oh, it's Nighthawks.
That's correct.
I do love that painting.
Great. I don't even know that other painting you mentioned. Is that Blur?
Swablur.
There's
a lot of different people in that one.
The year is 1944, and Big Bend National Park is established. Operation D-Day commences on these French beaches. This famous Tennessee Williams play debuts in Chicago, and this star of Matilda and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is born.
All right, so it's Danny DeVito.
Yep.
The Normandy beaches of Normandy. And then... 1944, is it Glass Menagerie?
That's correct.
It did premiere in Chicago. And let me tell you about that original production. It was the first time they ever created what looked like a floating box in the air.
Mm.
Like it was above the stage space and everything just looked like abyss around it.
And you would know because you were there, because you're 155.
That's right.
And you were in your prime then.
That was before the gray hairs.
Yeah. The year is 1903, and Wind Cave National Park is established. This Wizard of Menlo Park electrocuted an elephant. The first box of these waxy coloring instruments is sold. This automobile company is founded. Its Model T would eventually be released 5 years later.
Okay, so we're talking Thomas Edison.
Yep.
Crayons.
What kind of crayons, specifically?
Colored crayons.
Be specific.
Crayola crayons.
There we go, yep.
No, I lost the third one.
This automobile company is founded.
Oh, it's Ford.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, great.
The year is 2018, and Gateway Arch National Park is established. This former president and first lady both die. This store with mascot Jeffrey files for bankruptcy. This actress joins the royal family.
Okay, is it Carter?
No, Carter is still alive.
No, okay, Eisenhower.
No.
Oh, is it the Bushes? That's my answer.
Which Bushes?
Bush Senior.
Yes.
And Barbara.
Yes.
They did die together.
Not.
In each other's arms. Like The Notebook. And then what were the other ones?
The store with mascot Jeffrey files for bankruptcy. And this
that's
actress,
Toys R Us.
And this actress
and that's
joins
Meghan Markle.
That's correct. Just okay, cut great. Me off some more. The year is 1921 and Hot Springs National Park
and
is
established. And Mike was born.
And Hot Springs National Park is established. The first burial at this grave site occurs in Arlington National Cemetery. The Sheik, starring Rudolph Valentino, is released. He is later played by this actor in American Horror Story Hotel. Both Washington and Oregon are hit by this extreme weather event not typically seen on the West Coast.
Okay. Is it a hurricane in Washington and Oregon?
That's correct.
And then they buried a soldier in Arlington?
Yes, but it's a specific grave site.
A veteran.
It's a specific gravesite.
A precedent.
This is the first burial at this gravesite.
Then I don't know.
What is the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier?
Oh, okay. Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. That, no, I am familiar with that, and I did not remember it right now. And then what was the one I'm missing?
The Sheik, starring Rudolph Valentino, is released. He is later played by this actor in American Horror Story Hotel.
Elizabeth Taylor.
Incorrect.
I don't know.
Who is Finn Wittrock?
Finn Wittrock. Got it. He played that man.
Yes,
in
that's how
American
the clue was
Horror
delivered
Story
to you.
Hotel. I thought that the character appeared in American Horror Story Hotel, which would have also been a correct interpretation of that.
No.
Yeah.
Not how it was written.
Yeah, no, you said that. Mm-mm. No. Where I was getting confused is, read it one more time.
The Sheik, starring Rudolph Valentino,
good,
is released.
Okay, right there. Okay, so The Sheik, starring Rudolph Valentino, who is a dancer, is released.
He is later played by this actor in American Horror Story.
I thought you meant The Sheik, the character of The Sheik, is later played by this other actor.
No.
Who, as a character, appeared in American Horror Story. That's what I thought. There were some modifiers that I misplaced.
Yeah, you better go looking for them. And finally, the year is 1935 and Shenandoah National Park is established. These three college football games are played for the first time. You may think of Juice, Our Star, and What Mary Poppins Might Have Had You Swallow to get your answers. This famous crooner and king is born in Tupelo, Mississippi. This company, famous for Instant Pictures, releases the first commercially available color film.
Okay, so in backwards order, we got Polaroid, Fuji.
Sorry, Kodak. I screwed that up. Yeah.
Okay, so it is Polaroid.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Then Elvis Presley was born. And then we have the Sugar Bowl, the Orange Bowl, and the Rose Bowl.
Our Star.
Our Star.
Mm-hmm.
Like collectively our possessive,
like
star,
S-T-A-R. Our star that gives us warmth.
The Sun Bowl?
Mm-hmm.
I never heard of that, girl.
Well.
The Sun Bowl.
She exists.
Does she still exist today?
I don't know.
We're so straight, everybody.
Yeah.
We know, we definitely know that.
Mm-hmm.
I did know the Sugar Bowl though. And I did know the Orange Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. The Sun Bowl. I'm not going to lie. I really enjoyed that category. That was really fun.
Thanks.
Well done.
Thank you.
She said bitterly.
Always better.
This has been Gaze at the National Parks, the podcast, and we're here to remind you to hike early and hike often, and that adventure is always out there.
Gaze at the National Parks was created and is hosted by us,
Dustin Ballard
and Michael Ryan.
To see images from this episode, follow our Instagram at Gaze at the National Parks. To contact us, email us at gazeatthenationalparks@gmail.com. And to find out more about the parks visited on this show, visit our website, gazeatthenationalparks.com. And that's Gaze, G-A-Z-E.
All original artwork featured on Instagram, on our website, and in the Gaze Shop is by me, Michael Ryan.
All original music was written and performed by Dave Seaman and Mariello Klinger, with Sean Sklios on guitar. This episode was edited by me, Dustin Ballard.
We would also like to acknowledge that we're recording this episode that we are on the traditional and stolen lands of the Lenape people, also known as Ocean County, New Jersey.